Welcome to Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our series on Vietnam. And I think it's really important that when we talk about this subject, the purpose was not to get political so much. The purpose was not to look at all the more exciting, more graphic things. But I think the purpose was to look at the humans that were involved, the people that were involved. And, you know, if you think about this, that the average age of the person in Vietnam was about, was a little over 19. And with that, of the 58,000 people that were killed in Vietnam, over 20,000 were married. Also, all those kids had parents and fathers and brothers and sisters. So when we talk about the impact of somebody being in some place like Vietnam, we're talking for each person probably 20 people, and also, or more. And also, I think that today we're going to interview Lloyd Webster. And here's another one of my high school buddies that has agreed to talk to me on the radio. Lloyd, we also interviewed Dorsey. And I've also interviewed Jim McFarland, and just got off the phone with Alan Aronica. And Lloyd, he probably would be embarrassed if I said this, but he was one of those cool guys in high school, you know. But, you know, I mean, you know, the bar wasn't too high either, though, Lloyd. We only graduated with 160, you know. But,
it
couldn't
have been very high.
Yeah, so anyhow, but now he's a world-renowned pickleball player, and he did marry one of the prettiest girls in the high school, and I think he would agree with me on that, especially if he's going to play this back to, and listen to it later. Lloyd, one of the things that kind of strikes me about when I look at the pictures of the people that were in Vietnam, you know, the soldiers themselves, I almost feel like somebody just took a big butterfly net and picked up a whole bunch of guys from our graduating class and threw them in a war a whole far piece away. I mean, they were young people with hopes and dreams and everything. And they weren't all tremendous warriors. They were farmers. They were, you know, we worked at Mosier's. You probably worked with your parents in the, you know, out in the fields. And I think it might even have been when you were in Vietnam that I went and talked to your dad, because I think you had a 650 Honda or something that was for sale.
It wasn't a 650. It was much smaller than that, but it was a Honda.
Yeah, and I went and looked at it, and I almost bought it at one time. But tell me a little bit about you know, you enlisted in the Marines, correct?
I did. Yeah. When I got out of high school, pretty early on I decided that I wasn't mature enough to go to college. So I thought I've got a couple of options, and the one that stood out to me was to go into the military, because I figured this was back in 1966.
So right.
It was the handwriting was on the wall that something was going to happen. And if I didn't get some type of a deferment, I was going to go in. So I decided to enlist when I still had a choice of what branch of the service I could go into. So I did.
And there really were quite a few guys from our class that went into Marines. I think Link did.
Yeah.
Lave. Who else?
Yeah, about the same time I went in. I think there were probably four or five of us that went in.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, that was a long time ago. So.
Yeah, that's for sure.
There's an awful lot that I haven't even, I haven't thought about for years until you you called and asked if I would do this. I've gone back and tried to refresh my memory best I could. But
Did you ever look back at... look at other people like your same age, like right now, and you think, geez, they really look a lot older than me. You know, what happened? What happened to them? They really got taken through the mill, and I look so darn young. You know what? I guess I was just blessed. But so tell me a little, too. I think it's kind of an interesting story. But when did you propose to Karen?
Oh, I was actually in boot camp. We had finished our basic training and then went into, I think it's called advanced infantry training in Camp Pendleton, California.
Uh-huh.
And I was in a, it was a real foggy night. I was in a phone booth and it was an 18-year-old proposal. I believe it went something like, I think we should get married when I get home on leave.
Yeah, that's a good way to
literally.
Do it. Did she say yes? Did she say yes immediately?
Of course, in my mind, she did. I'd have to go back and replay it. But,
yeah.
I believe that she did.
Well, I'm glad you didn't, you know, say, it was a foggy night, and I've got nothing better to do, so why don't I propose to my wife?
Right.
but it's worked out pretty well, right? I mean, you've been married for what? 51 years, right? 52?
54 years.
Wow.
This February, yeah.
Wow. I'm working on 50 this year, so, and I thought I was one of the last remaining prehistoric marriages. Tell me what you did when you were in Vietnam and where were you located? Well, first of all, what was your first impression when you hit Vietnam and got off that airplane?
Well, we went over, I was in the an intermediate maintenance shop supporting an F-4 Phantom squadron.
Uh-huh.
And we went over as an entire squadron. So we were on a C-131. And the first indication that this is probably not going to be a bed of roses was when we had to circle the airport for about an hour because they were clearing the runways from Viet Cong. They called them zappers at the time. They had satchels and with explosives.
C-4 or something in it, yeah.
Yeah, who knows? I don't think they even had C-4 back then. But,
yeah, nothing good in the basket, though.
Right, yeah. But when we got off the aircraft, I think it was around 1 o'clock in the morning, something like that. And I literally believed that I was walking into a sauna. It was so hot and humid. It's still at 1 a.m. And I just my first thought was, oh my God, this is bad now. What's it going to be like, you know, in daylight?
Yeah,
but it was coming from Ellensburg, Washington. You're pretty sheltered. You don't experience a lot, and so it was my first experience where I was totally out of my element.
Yeah, probably not baling much hay there in at the airport.
No, they didn't bale any hay at all.
Yeah. and I think, you know, that's the one comment, and I've mentioned this before in my previous interviews, but, you know, with Dorsey and with everybody that I interviewed before, I've got comments like, you know, when you got out of the plane, you know, they said you could literally chew the atmosphere. You could chew the air. It was just thick and either dusty or super, super hot. So for everybody
who has been over there, there's a certain smell also that is, it's a dank, you know, because of the moisture. And then, of course, there's jet fumes, and we were on an air base, so there were a lot of aircraft taking off and landing, and so there was always that
fuel, probably
smell of fuel, and it wasn't a very pleasant odor. You got used to it, but it wasn't a pleasant odor.
I had one person describe it to me as, I said, well, what does it smell like? And he said, well, to give you an idea, it smells worse than opening up that cottage cheese container in the back of your refrigerator and, you know, taking a whiff of it for the first time, you know. So, yeah, I think that was, you know, that's the other thing that really was true. I mean, there was Agent Orange around the airports. There was, you know, all the diesel fuel, the planes taking off, you know, helicopters produced a tremendous amount of, you know, oil. They weren't exactly, they didn't have any electric helicopter, any Teslas at that time. So, so where did you go from there? Did you stay there at the airbase or?
Yeah, I first went over, again, we went over as an entire squadron, and we went to Da Nang Air Base in August of 1968. And stayed in Da Nang, working again on air data computers, autopilot generators, that type of thing off the F-4 Phantom. Then in September of in January, I believe it was, in 1969, we moved from Da Nang Air Base to Chu Lai Air Base. And I spent the rest of my time in Chu Lai.
One of my interviewees had a picture of a Bob Hope a visit at Chu Lai at the airbase.
Right, yeah.
And, so you know, it's interesting, too, because I think people should know this, that they said, you know, we think about Vietnam as people out in the fields, you know, walking across rice paddies, but for every person that's in the infantry and is out there walking, there were 23 other people that supported that operation,
from
supplies to clerks to, you know, repairing things. And my my neighbor, two doors up, flew F-4s, and his name is Max Clevenger, but it was interesting because he had told me many times that you know, that they relied on the people on the ground to do it right. And Jim McFarland said when he was repairing helicopters, he said when up for the test flight, they always made the guy that repaired the helicopter go with him for the test flight, you know.
Yeah.
You know, make sure they got the propeller put on the right way and everything, you know.
But, exactly, yeah.
But when you were there, did you... were you? You said you were working a lot of hours. Is that correct?
Yeah, we did 12-hour shifts, so it was 12 on, 12 off.
And you were in a pretty small area right there at the airbase, right?
Well, the airbase itself was reasonably big. Da Nang was one of the largest airbases there in north of Saigon. Saigon, of course, had that was a much larger base, but Da Nang was a pretty large base. Chu Lai was a fairly small base. I don't even know how many people were in our squadron, to be honest with you. It was
sure. And you were all Marines, correct?
Well, all Marines, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But we had it relatively easy. We had a hut to sleep in. I think there were eight of us in a hut, and we would get trucked over to our shop and do our thing, and you know, get trucked back to eat lunch, and you know, so it was. If you had to be there, it was one of the better jobs to have.
Right. A lot of the people also tell me that if they would haul in air conditioned trailers and stuff for the officers. So that was interesting. But
there you go. I was an E3, and I got to work in an air conditioned van. So
that's good. Let me, if you wouldn't mind, you know, tell me the story that we discussed on the, if you feel comfortable doing that, tell me the story about the polka dots.
Well,
I stuck you now, didn't I? Give me,
yeah. Well, I mentioned that you worked 12-hour days, and you know, you weren't totally busy all 12 hours, but we were fairly busy, and this was probably 11 months into my 13-month tour, and after a while, you get a little rummy, and you start to do things that aren't necessarily military-like. But I was, I was 19 years old. No, I think I was 20. I might have even been 21 at the time. But anyway, I had my job was to take in the bare data computers and do calibration and maintenance on them. And every once in a while, you get tired of writing down a serum number. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be great to have, I'll just name them. So I started naming my air data computers. You know, it was like Betty or Alice or, you know, something like that. And then after another month or so, I decided, well, you know, they're just gray. They're military gray. Wouldn't it be nice?
So not so attractive. You needed a little Martha Stewart in there.
Exactly. Yeah, you've got to spruce them up a little bit. They each have their own personality, so you've got to embellish them a little bit. So I got this brilliant idea to paint polka dots on them, and everything was going fine for the first day or so, and then my sergeant woke me up one morning and said, hey, I don't know what you did, but the CEO wants to see you. Well, evidently the CEO was on his way to board his aircraft to take off that day. Saw somebody installing, probably Betty, because she's the one that has the, you know, the wildest personality.
Yes.
And he didn't like that much. So he wanted to find out who in the world did that. So I got called in and told that it wasn't appropriate.
Yes. Polka dots.
So I had to paint them all gray again, which was really demoralizing.
Yeah, so, you couldn't even put polka dots on an F-4 Phantom. That's just...
I thought back about some of the World War II planes that you saw. You know, they had, you know, Betty Boop.
Betty Boop? Yeah, they had, yeah.
You know, and so I figured, well, you might as well be able to paint some of the individual components, but evidently not.
Yeah, well...
I learned later, you can't.
Well, and we have changed, I would bet a lot of money right now that on Air Force One, we're not going to see a large cleavage woman leaning back in a prone, you know, position on the front of our airplane. So
probably not.
You know. So anyhow, that would be that'd be interesting. We certainly have changed and have done some things a lot differently. What did you think when you found out you were going home?
Well, you always knew when you were going home. I mean, you were there for 13 months. So, I mean, the countdown started the day you got there. So within a day or two, you pretty much knew exactly, you know, when you were getting home. So it wasn't a surprise. There were phrases, I can't remember them all, but, you know, I'm so short that, you know, I can walk under a ping pong net and, you know, those kind of things. So short being, you know,
yes,
don't have
yes.
much more time in country. And so there were all kinds of phrases, but it was something you just, I mean, you thought about every day you thought about, that day you got to go home. And it was a pretty, jubilant group of guys that when the plane finally took off and the wheels came up, that was the first time. Everybody was just kind of sitting there white knuckled until they heard the wheels retract, and then it just an explosion of cheers. And so it was good.
And you landed back in, when you came back to the States, where did you land?
Well, I went to Okinawa for, I think I was in transition. I was in Okinawa for a couple of days, Okinawa, Japan, for a couple of days, just on base there.
My brother-in-law was there in Okinawa. I think they had a lot of communication stuff there.
Yeah. And then we flew back into El Toro. So I took off out of El Toro to Vietnam, and I came back to El Toro when I returned.
And then you got back to Ellensburg when? How long after that?
Well, I didn't go back to Ellensburg. Karen, my wife, moved to Huntsville, Alabama while I was gone. Her sister lived in Huntsville, so she went back to Huntsville for the 13 months that I was there. So I went from El Toro back to Huntsville, and then we drove back to California and spent the rest of my, I think I had another year and a half to go before I got out.
So you're pretty sure that after that romantic proposal, she didn't try to ditch you in Huntsville?
I was awfully glad to see her at the airport. I'll put it that way.
I bet you were. I bet you were, and I bet you she was glad to see you too. Any time during the time that you were in Vietnam that you felt like you were in any danger, or was there always just kind of an apprehension? Or
A couple of times. Again, we were on a base, and we used to take mortar rounds. We would probably 2-3 times a week, we would have either mortar or rockets attacking the base. And it could have been the north end of the base, and I was in the south end. But you never knew for sure where they were going to land. So
right.
We were, you know, it was an inconvenience more than anything. You'd have to scramble out of your bunk and get into a bunker someplace, you know. But one night, it was a totally different sound. This huge sound of some type of a projectile going over your head. And it lasted a long time. It lasted about an hour and a half, which is very unusual. Usually a mortar or a rocket attack lasted maybe 10 minutes and that was it. Because they were shooting off, and of course we could see the people in the helicopters and the airplanes could see where they were coming from, so they would go attack it. Well, so it was very unusual when this attack lasted an hour and a half. Well, what we found out later, the next day, it wasn't incoming at all. It was actually the Navy was firing big guns over our heads. To a group of Viet Cong that were stationing themselves outside of our base. So it was a good thing, but at the same time, it was very scary because it was so different. But I mean, the noise was horrendous, and we kept thinking, "What in the world is going on out there?" But that was one of the more frightening things that happened in our bunker.
Well,
there were a couple.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say there were a couple. If a projectile is going over your head, that's the best way for it to go. You know, and preferably really high too, off of your head.
Well, these didn't seem very high, but you never know.
Yeah, yeah. It's
the only other time that I felt fear. Real serious fear was we used to have to do sweeps of there were small Vietnamese villages that helped support the air base. People would come in and clean our barracks, and we had regular shops and a barber and that type of thing, but they would live in these villages outside the base. Well, every once in a while they would change the military currency because the locals, the Vietnamese, weren't supposed to have military currency, but they always seemed to get it. So from time to time, they would change. They were called NPCs, I believe. They would change them out from, you know, maybe a blue color to a red color. And we would do a sweep of the villages and get everybody out in the field, and they would have to turn over any contraband that they had. Well, I was an air guy. I was an air wing guy. I didn't know anything about maneuvering. But we lined up, and we were supposed to go through this village and root out the people. And I started heading down this alley, and all of a sudden the alley got from, you know, 8-10 feet wide to, it seemed to me, like about 3 feet wide. And every corner I went around, it just continued on, and I didn't know where I was going. And it was frightening. It was, I was totally out of my element. And I realized then I was so fortunate to be in the air wing, because I don't know if I would have been able to survive doing that for a living over there.
Probably felt pretty vulnerable in a situation like that, or you don't know what's around every corner, you know. And
exactly. And like I said, we weren't trained to do that. So how I got, you know, separated from the rest of my group, I have no idea, but I did.
Yeah. And that's interesting, because I know one of the other, Alan talked about the difference in the money and the piastres and that the Vietnamese were not supposed to hold, if the Viet Cong did not want them to have, American currency or anything like that, then they were in pretty deep trouble.
Correct.
What was, when you got back, how did people treat you?
We'll start. When I first got, I went to Okinawa, they warned us to not to wear any military gear going back into the state, to wear whatever civilian clothes you had, because we weren't treated very well when we came back. And we, at that time, I came back on a military aircraft. A lot of people would come back on a commercial. Uh-huh. But so I got some civilian clothes, and I came back wearing civilian clothes. And then when I went to Huntsville, Alabama, to get my wife, I felt like people didn't know how to talk to me. It was almost like they didn't trust me, and I didn't know if they thought, you know, I was some wacko guy that just got back from the war, or exactly what it was. But I felt separated. I felt ostracized just a little bit. I mean, they were fine. They didn't treat me poorly, but they certainly weren't very welcoming. And I just, you know, part of it was probably just my own impression of what might be going on in their heads.
And also, that's got to be pretty much, you know, you've got a transition going in there to Vietnam, and running around the field in the hot weather, and you've got a transition coming out of there, you know, from no matter where you were, flight back. You know, I mean, I talked about people having the plane shot at when they're leaving the airbase, or, you know, for the last time. And to a relatively, safe place. And all of a sudden, I would think it's like you say people didn't know how to talk to you. And I kind of understand that. You know, sometimes you get in a position with someone and you just don't have that comfort. So anyhow, you did a great interview, Lloyd. And you were hesitant. I'm admitting you were hesitant, you know, but old nurse with his charms talked you into it. So thank you so much. I really do appreciate that. And I'll let you know. And when this is going to be on, and you can play it for your all your relatives. So you give Karen a hug for me, and maybe we'll see you when we get down there to St. George.
Okay. Sounds good.
Hey, thanks, Lloyd. Good talking to you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.